really thrilled to present the first in a series of three programs on the intersection of art and activism in the Anthropocene. We are especially grateful to Guernica Magazine for bringing this program to us and for Orion Magazine for their support as well. And thanks to all of you for coming. Before we begin, a couple housekeeping notes. First, if you have cell phones or any other devices that may make noise, please turn them off. We are also broadcasting a presentation and a Q&A, and we are also, for the first time, broadcasting it on Facebook Live. It's a brave new world for the library. So, books are available for sale by our friends from the corner bookstore outside, so please take advantage of that, and I'm sure the authors will be talking to Simon afterward. And now let me introduce our panelists. Chantal Filodieu is a playwright and translator whose work focuses on the intersection of science, policy, art, and climate change. She is the artistic director of the Arctic Cycle, an organization created to support the writing, development, and production of eight plays that look at the social and environmental changes taking place in eight countries of the Arctic. And she's also the founder of the blog and international network, Artists in Climate Change. She is co-organizer of Climate Change Theater Action, and a worldwide series of readings and performances of short climate change plays presented in support of the United Nations COP. Davis Wells-Wells is a deputy editor at New York Magazine, where he also writes often about climate science in the near future, including his 2017 cover story, The Uninhabitable Earth, on worst-case scenarios for global warming. This story quickly became the most read story in New York Magazine's history, and Ashley understanding is terrifying. Before joining New York, David was deputy editor at the Paris Review and previously served as the New York Sun's books editor. He's currently working on a book about the meaning of global warming, not just how climate chaos will transform and degrade the planet, but also how it will shape our culture, our politics, our psychology, and philosophy. William T. Bowman is the National Book Award-winning author of 10 novels, 4 collections of stories, a memoir, and 6 works of nonfiction, all in our stacks. His latest book is the 2-volume Carbon Ideologue, which explores global warming and the factors in human actions that have led to it, including descriptions of Bowman's own risky ventures to the no-go zones of Fukushima, Japan, following the nuclear reactor meltdowns. The series' first volume, No Immediate Danger, is on sale, available outside, and booksellers can also take advance orders for the second volume, which will be coming out in June. And last but not least, our moderator this evening is Amy Grady, and she is the deputy publisher of Guernica Magazine and also senior editor at the Chicago Review of Books. So thank you all, and let's have a program.
Thank you, Carolyn, so much for that great introduction, and thank you to the New York Society Library for having us this evening in this beautiful, beautiful space. As Carolyn mentioned, my name is Amy Brady. I am the deputy publisher of Guernica Magazine, and for those of you who haven't heard of us, we have been publishing online since 2004, mostly at the intersection of global arts and politics. We have published, to my mind, some of the greatest writers working today, as well as many talented up-and-coming writers who, after publishing with us, move on to even greater things. So we are a great space for important, vital, incisive voices. And as a nonprofit magazine, we are run entirely by a group of volunteers and depend largely on the support of our friends to keep going. So if you'd like to know more about the magazine, please don't hesitate to come and chat with me after tonight's talk. And there are also some information sheets at the back if you'd like to know more. I also want to thank all of you guys for being here this evening. This is a very important topic, and it's so nice to share space with some like-minded individuals who are as interested in this topic as we are. And of course, I am very thankful for our wonderful panel of guests who are here this evening. It is a privilege and a pleasure to be sharing this platform with you guys, and I am so excited to talk about the work that you're doing and how it contributes to our greater conversation of art, activism, and climate change. The three of you approach talking about climate change through different mediums, but the one thing that does that you guys all do have in common is the fact that you do talk about climate change in such a way that makes it seem like the vital and important topic that it is. So to begin tonight, I want to start at the beginning and just ask you guys, what drew you to this topic, and what motivated you to address it in the stories that you tell? Chantal, do you want to begin?
So it was a combination of things that made me interested in climate change. I was interested in the environment in my personal life, because I like to hike. You know, my father was a bush pilot, so he would take us up north. I'm originally from Canada, in Quebec, and his big thing was to go to lakes that were only accessible by plane. So I was used to being outside in nature. And then in 2007, I have a friend who I met outside of the country who lives in Alaska and runs an air taxi company out of Denali National Park. And I had known him for about 10 years, and I always promised I would go and visit and had never been. And I hadn't been in touch with him for about 6 years, and then my phone rang. And it was him, and he said, "I just wanted to know if your phone number was still good." So I said, "Okay, this summer I'm coming to visit you." So I went to Alaska, and of course 2007 was a year after Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth came out. So the combination of having climate change more present in the public conversation, and then experiencing it firsthand and hearing people in Alaska who of course were already affected by it, really drew my attention to it, and then that's when I started thinking, oh, maybe this is something I can address in my work, which I had never thought of before. So it was all of these things together, and then of course even addressing it in my work, at first I thought, this is not going to work, it's going to be boring, and so it took a little while, and then eventually I locked onto an idea, and I continued.
I think the short answer is fear, basically. As a journalist, I was sort of always poking around news from science and looking at scientific papers, looking at sort of fringier parts of the internet to find real news of the near future. And the more that I was doing that over the last few years, the more that I was seeing really alarming new findings about climate. And, you know, in my daily readings of New York Times and the New Yorker and all the other, you know, kind of mainstream publications that I read all the time, I felt that there was a huge gap between what the science was saying about what was going to happen to our planet and how that story was being told to people who weren't as engaged in the issue as even someone like I was. And I'm not an environmentalist. I've lived my whole life in New York. I have no special love for nature, and my commitment on climate change is really about concern for human life in a damaged world. And you know, the more that I learned about what was happening, what was likely to happen, the more I realized that this wasn't about ecosystems being damaged in distant places, and it wasn't about shorelines rising up a few feet, but for everyone 100 miles from the shoreline, that would be fine. It was something that was going to transform every aspect of human life everywhere on the planet. And it just seemed to me as a kind of, even on a kind of entrepreneurial, journalistic level, that story was not at all being told. And as a result, I was like, let me dive in, let me tell that story. And as a result of that, I find myself sort of as a accidental activist advocate who feels even more than before that the story is really urgent, overwhelming, and you know, pushes aside any other story that you might want to tell about the near future.
girl named Lisa, who's now getting big. She's 19. And I was always very, very resistant to and resentful of this issue. I thought, you know, this is not going to affect me. And I have so many other things to worry about. I just hate even thinking about it. I went to Fukushima, Japan, shortly after the tsunami reactor disaster. And what I saw was quite horrible. That was the beginning of my thinking and walking around through these red zones. At first, they weren't so bad. They looked just very recently abandoned, so you might find a potted plant was just beginning to wilt, or an umbrella, you know, leaning up in a door. But as the years went by, these places, of course, got creepier and creepier, with vines growing over the signs, weeds coming up through the sidewalk, snow drifting in through broken windows, and high radiation readings that I measured. The more I talked to the utility company, TEPCO, and the people who were suffering as a result of this, the more opposed to nuclear power I became. So then I thought, well, what's better? Which is the worst of these four fuels? Nuclear, oil, natural gas, and coal? And unfortunately, the answer I came to was all of them.
Thank you. Bill, you write about your trip to Fukushima in your latest two-volume book. I had the great pleasure of reading that, and I was really struck by the structure of it because it reads like a letter to the future that is part apology and part explanation for why we didn't do more in the here and now to mitigate climate change. And so I would love to know why that structure, why a letter to the future and a focus on the now instead of perhaps say what we might be able to do if we could actually put some solutions into action.
Well, for one thing, it's easier to be calm about the whole thing if we just suppose that it's already over, our generation is gone and we've left the world worse than we found it, and they're wondering why we were so foolish. And the second reason is that, unfortunately, there really is very little that any of us in this room can do about it. It's not a matter of, setting the thermostat a little differently. A lot of these greenhouse gases are released through processes such as agriculture. Rice growing in Japan, which seems very innocuous, releases 50% of that country's methane, which is a very dangerous greenhouse gas. Manufacturing all over the world is extremely wasteful. When molten metal is turned into sheet metal, about half of the metal has to be remelted, just because we're not bothering to really think about how to design our sheet metal. There are all these things that need to be worked on, and we can't do it. All we can do is make a noise and hope that we get some government officials, some regulators, who are not foxes in the greenhouse. And I don't have much hope there.
Well, speaking of not having much hope, David, last summer you wrote the article, The Uninhabitable Earth. As Carolyn said, it was quite scary, but it generated a lot of attention and conversation. I think it was somebody at Slate who called it the silent spring of our time. But that article, among the things that were said about it, were some criticisms by a lot of people in the scientific community and in the journalistic community, who said that the piece was almost too scary, and that it was actually damaging the conversations that we could be happening. That was last summer that you wrote that. In the months since then, what is your thinking on how we should be talking about climate change? Is fear a useful tool?
Yeah, I personally, I think very much so. I heard a lot in the aftermath of the article's publication from people who felt that that there was a real risk of turning off possible activists or turning off possible political activity, that there would be a kind of a burnout effect, or that people would give up hope and lose faith that anything could be done. And I think, a lot of those criticisms came from activists themselves, and I do think that among people who have devoted themselves and their lives to this issue, that is a risk. You can sort of start to give up and lose energy. But when I look at, the country as a whole, the planet as a whole, it just strikes me as so transparently true that the average person is not scared enough about climate change, rather than that they're too scared about climate change. And it felt to me, and still feels to me, that if the risk is turning off a few activists, and the benefit is turning on many, 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 many more people, especially given, as Bill was saying, that the main thing that we need to do if we want to forestall these damaging effects is take political action, that's a trade-off that is very much worth making. On top of which, there was just the argument of, like, it's the truth. It was funny to watch as the article came out, and the response to it, which was much, much bigger than I would have anticipated, as a result generated a lot more conversation among the scientists on whose work I was depending than I expected. And a number of them did object to the sort of overall gloomy tone, the headlining, the name of the piece, and a couple of the more dramatic statements about what could happen. But the sort of detail by detail factual accuracy of the article was, it was so directly pulled from their papers that they couldn't possibly object to it. But it did raise this issue, which I actually had written about a little bit in the piece, in part because some of them had spoken with me about it, called scientific reticence, which is the tendency of people who are doing this work to not want to share the scariest information that they've uncovered with the public for fear that it would be damaging, undermine public action, or scare people, turn people off too much. And, there are a lot of reasons why I found that impulse objectionable. But I would just say, sort of chiefly, as a journalist, I feel like if there is news, if it's good enough to publish in Science or publish in Nature, then an interested public should be trusted to interpret it and respond to it on their own. And that the idea that those who know the science best should be editing what they learn in order to sort of protect the public, that's patronizing and problematic. But it's also, as again, if we're trying to produce political action, it's, I think, really damaging. I think that there's an enormous amount of energy that can come from fear, and people do organize and take action if they're scared. And there were just so much being left on the table if we said that we were not going to be willing to scare people. And it also, then there's also the issue of trust, which is to say, like, just over the last year since my article was published, we had this unprecedented hurricane season in the Caribbean. We had this unprecedented wildfire season in California. People haven't really heard about the flooding in South Asia that took place this past year, but we are already entering into a new era for climate disaster. And I think that the world is waking up to how dramatic these changes will be. And if scientists continue to say, more or less, changes are happening, but it's all going to be okay, I think that they risk alienating the public that they're really hoping to reach. And one of the things I was trying to do in my piece was to reach that public. So, yeah.
Chantel, I want to talk to you, as a theater practitioner, about the public for a moment, because I think a lot of people go to the theater as a form of escape. And your theater is, I'm going to want to use the word political in the sense that climate change is a politicized topic, and especially as it is in this country. So who is your ideal audience member? Is it somebody who's already on board with climate change and just wants to see an artistic representation of it? Are you hoping to change minds with your work? Who do you hope is in the seat?
Theater is such a rarefied art form that I can't imagine that anybody who is not concerned about climate change would show up to see a play about it. So, it's not in my best interest to think that I'm going to change minds. There are some instances where I've been in a situation where people who didn't necessarily believe came, and this was, I had a play done at Kansas State University, and I know for a fact that there was a student in the play whose family didn't believe in climate change at all, and yet they came and they supported this person, because it was their son. So, there might be a few instances like that where somebody would come, but otherwise it's a self-selected audience. So I go on, I think of the study, The Six Americas, that was done by, I think it's Yale and George Mason, which separates the Americans into six categories in relation to climate change, from the most alarmed to the deniers, and then a series of categories in between of people who are concerned. And the alarmed are actually a small percentage, and the deniers are a small percentage, and most people are somewhere in between. And so I'm thinking, okay, somebody who's going to come and see a play about climate change might be, they're already thinking about it, they're willing to go as far as going to see a play about it, then maybe the play can help them take an extra step. Maybe they think about it, but maybe now they're going to do something. And one of my personal favorite success was an event we did this past fall, where there was we showed a few very short plays, and there was a conversation afterwards, and there was a man in the audience who, at the end of the evening, said, I've been thinking about this for a while now, and I think I'm ready to take another step in my life and become more active. And a play is just sort of one more little thing, but it just happened to be the tipping point, I think, for him at that point. But I keep hoping that you give people a bunch of little things and eventually they reach the tipping point.
So, as we can kind of see here, you guys are all writing in very different mediums and are taking some different approaches to the study of climate change. But again, another thing that you all have in common is that you all engage in some impressive research to write the things that you do. That said, in conversations that I've had with scientists and other writers, it seems like that climate change is notoriously difficult to write about because it contains so many data sets and so many different types of science, a lot of it rather esoteric and difficult to understand if you're not a specialist. So with that said, I would love to hear from each of you about when you're researching, how you know you have something that is the spark for a story, or maybe put another way, how you shape that research into a narrative that people like me can understand. Bill, should we start with you?
Sure. I had so much help on this book from experts, and one man who really helped me is a guy named Peter Tons at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He corrected my numbers, and he told me one thing that really shocked me. I kept thinking, well, if only we could sign the Paris Accords and reduce our emissions and so forth. All of these different greenhouse gases are measured in terms of the 100-year global warming potential of carbon dioxide, which is our most prevalent greenhouse gas. It's about 80%. Dr. Tons told me that having a 100-year descriptor is ridiculous. He said in 2,000 years that carbon dioxide will warm 8 times as much as in that 100 years. If we stop all of our emissions tomorrow, some of that carbon dioxide is still going to be warming the planet and elevating the oceans for up to 7,000 or 8,000 years. That was something that really sank in with me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've been really blinded by how much the reporting and conversation about climate ends at the year 2100. Mm-hmm. You know, there are the people who study the Arctic ice sheets and the oceans say that in the end game, the oceans are going to be at least 50 meters higher than they are now. and there's also this amazing fact I learned the other day that the net effect of our non-carbon pollution, all the aerosols that we have in the air, all the other stuff that we burn, has been keeping the planet about a degree Celsius cooler than it would be otherwise, which is, that's pollution that's killing literally hundreds of thousands of people each day. But if we took that out of the air, then we'd have a planet that was already at 2 degrees Celsius, which is the Paris goal, which not that long ago was defined as the threshold of climate catastrophe, and is now our like optimistic scenario. So yeah, it's the more you learn, really, the more harrowing it is. To your more particular question, I mean, I came to this subject as an amateur, as an eager reader, but as an amateur, and I mostly tested myself. So if there was some bit of news that I screamed holy shit about when I was reading, I was like, this is an exciting piece of, you know, I have kind of a perverse cast of mind, so I was like, this is like an exciting thing to include in my article. And things that I felt were a little more dry or familiar, I was like less inclined to emphasize. But I also think that personally, working on this mostly over the last few years, I've been lucky because there's been a lot of really interesting, exciting, emerging new science in areas that had not yet really been written about or talked about. You know, for decades we've known a lot about sea level rise. We've known a bit about some of the other, you know, some of the effects on the direct heat effects and that kind of thing. But there's all of this emerging research about the effect on economic growth, on conflict. There's even some new research, which I didn't get a chance to write about the effect on mental health. And all of these areas have been basically untouched by sort of most climate writers and most climate scientists. And so there was just this bounty of new, exciting research to unload on the reader. And I think one of the reasons that my magazine story was so successful was that it did feel new in that way. I think that most kind of liberal, middle-of-the-road readers, people who read the climate coverage in the New York Times every day and the Washington Post occasionally, that kind of person, they were familiar with the threat, the sea level threat. They were familiar with you know, the melting of the ice caps. But the idea that we'd be losing an enormous amount of our capacity to produce food over the next century, or that we'd be dealing with a complete new scale of global epidemic because of climate change, all of these were really, really new ideas to them, and as a result, like, really terrifying. And it meant that it added up to a story that was, as I said before, global, total. Mm-hmm. It was not a matter of, well, if you live on the coast, buy some land 20 miles inland and you'll be fine. It was really like every aspect of your life, no matter who you are, no matter where you are, will be affected over the next decades, and there's no escaping it.
With the arts, I feel it's a little bit different because it's not really, I don't see it as my responsibility to convey like the facts, you know. It's not, I don't have the same responsibility as the journalist or the scientist as to convey really the fact of climate change. I do want the stories I tell to be accurate, but it's less in the detail and it's more about finding, I think it's about taking the science and finding what it means, and also what it means to humans. Like, theater is very much about putting people on stage. So how can the science be translated into what it means to people in their day-to-day life? Like, how can we take this big thing and then bring it down to a lifetime, or even sometimes it can be longer, but something that's a bit more, maybe more accessible and more readily understandable than sometimes just looking at the big picture. So I do a lot of research and talk to people, but then I try to distill that research and to put just enough to make people curious. So at the intermission, you know, they're looking stuff up on their phone, or they ask me, okay, well, you know, which book should I read, or who should I talk to? So it's a point to try to invite people to go deeper.
Just to pick up on that for a second, I mean, I think, I was talking a minute ago about all the research, but I think the thing that seems most missing to me when I look at it and think about how people are engaging with climate change is the storytelling. I mean, the truth is, like, the data is out there. It's in the CNN stories, it's in the New York Times stories, if you're reading it. It's just that those stories are so often told in such clinical ways and such segmented ways that you miss the big picture. And there's an incredible urgent need for great storytelling about climate that really connects those dots for people. And as you say, like, places the story in the context of a single life or a single set of lives so that they know that, you know, this is not, we're not talking about the year 2300 when who knows what technology will be available to us. These are conflicts and, you know, impacts that are going to be felt not just by our children, but by us in our lifetimes. I think that's an incredibly important story that really has not been told nearly enough. People often talk about the pace of climate change, and that what they mean is that they think it's so slow that we have a hard time grasping it. But I think really the thing is that it's too fast for us to be thinking seriously about. That, you know, I often say that half of all the carbon that we've emitted in the history of humanity has been emitted since Al Gore published his first book on climate, which is like since Tiger Woods played his first like Masters, since the Notorious B.I.G. released Ready to Die. Like this is not a long period of time, and we've done more than half of the damage that we've done to the environment in just that 25-year period. That's incredibly fast when you think about what kind of damage, what the scale of the damage that we're talking about. And I think that we've really not done a good enough job of storytelling about that speed. Every year that we're not taking action is just another, you know, it's really, really bad.
And I think there's something very hopeful about storytelling, even though the outcome may be very dire. And, you know, I'm not invested, or I don't have a strong opinion as to whether we're going to make it as a species or not. And in a way, it almost doesn't matter to me, because it's a little bit like, if I bring it down to a personal level, it's like being diagnosed with a terminal illness. Do you like try to live your days with dignity and fight until the end, or do you ask the doctor all the terrible ways in which it's going to hurt and, you know, be bad and just give into that? So I think the most important thing, I mean, if we want to keep our integrity as a species, it's just like, let's try to go through this with as much dignity as possible, and let's do try to make it, you know, so the Earth is livable, but I don't think that should be, in a way, the thing we focus on, because there's so much of it that's out of our hands. I think it's just about, like, day to day, like, how do we make this better?
Yeah, I really agree. And one of the things that Chantal wrote in her play, Sila, I thought was quite sad, but also consoling at the same time, so I wrote it down. We may use our breath when we roam the land, but we must surrender it once we pass from the land. Creatures who are lonely are the ones who hold on to their breath as if it were theirs and theirs alone. I think that's very beautifully put. And I tend to think a little bit that way when I'm writing for this unknown future, which might be a future that's a beetle civilization, for all we know. We may be long gone.
Thank you. So one of the key words in the title of this panel series is activism, art and activism in the Anthropocene. As journalists, a novelist, a playwright, do you guys see yourselves also as activists?
Yes. Yes, I used to say no, and then people would correct me all the time. They would point out all the ways in which I was being an activist, so now I say yes. And there's one project in particular that we do that is very much about activism, and it's called, you mentioned it when you introduced me, Amy, it's called Climate Change Theater Action. And it happens every other year. We did it in 2015, just this past fall. We commissioned 50 writers from around the world, so every continent is represented, to write a short play, 5 minutes long, about an aspect of climate change. And then we made this collection of 50 plays available to people who want to present an event. It was in the seven weeks around COP23. And so the plays are free. People can do readings, performances. Some of them have done radio shows, site-specific presentations at the foot of glaciers. There are people here who did events that involve dancing. And it's about helping people, giving people the tools to have a conversation that is not based in science necessarily, and it's not also based in politics, and where they can bring all of themselves. You know, they can actually talk about being afraid or not knowing what to do. Like, the emotions can be dealt with, as opposed to being in a more sort of maybe more clinical environment or something where it's a bit more loaded. So that project is very much about trying to help people, again, go one step further. And in addition to the theatrical presentation, we ask people to do an action if they can, which is either connecting. So in the case, there have been several universities who have participated, and they connect with other departments, which doesn't happen too often, like with the environmental science or with the hard sciences. Or it was about taking maybe a political step, like writing letters to representatives or something like that. So that project, I feel, is like giving people artistic tools and encouraging them to be activists too.
I think I think of myself mostly still as a storyteller rather than an activist, but it's sort of hard to avoid doing the work of activism when you're telling this kind of story. It's sort of electrifying on a moral level, and you see that in the response that it generates in readers, and that's exciting. I mean, obviously, I care deeply about the fate of the planet, and if I can do a little bit to help that, that's fantastic. But I would say, in sort of day-to-day way, my main objectives are really still about storytelling more than activism. But I'm actually especially curious to know what Bill says, since in your that beautiful opening to your new book, you sort of write about how you are not doing enough, and none of us are doing enough. So I'm curious to know how you answer that question.
Well, I wish I could do something good and important in my life before I die. If someone read Carbon Ideologies and said, "Oh, Bill, you know, now I understand climate change," I would say, "I didn't do enough." If Mr. Pruitt called me up and said, "Bill, I changed my mind," then I'd feel pretty good.
As you guys have been studying this issue and writing about this issue, again, climate change entails so many different types of science and people, and it exists in a span of time and geographical space that I think is sometimes difficult for people to grasp. So I know personally, whenever I am reading about it, my mind is constantly being blown about what we are doing to the planet, what we have done to the planet. So I'm really curious if you guys could pick up the one thing that has surprised you the most in your research about climate change, what would it be? And she's there.
Well, I think for me the biggest thing really is that speed fact. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that to think that this planet was basically entirely stable climate-wise when my father was born, and then by the time that I die, it will be in a state of complete climate chaos. And that is the result of the way that we've lived in those intervening generations. And as a result, you know, everything that we do acquires this sort of almost mythological scale. I mean, we are really taking the planet into our own hands every day as a species, and we now have the responsibility of trying to save it over the course of the next century or so. This is not, you know, an endeavor of the scale that humans have ever found themselves engaged in before, and that to me is sort of the grandest, like most kind of, you know, stoner, mind-blowing thing that has occurred to me. I mean, this is really drama at the scale of allegory and parable, but it is real. And we are those actors, we are those gods, we are those, and yet we are behaving as though the story is unfolding, you know, completely out of our control, and we have, you know, we're just watching it, which is really dispiriting.
Yeah, there was one thing that surprised me recently, and I think it was an article by Elizabeth Colbert, who said that in the models that scientists use to predict where we will be, they take into consideration technology to capture carbon, and none of that technology will be able to scale fast enough to do something. And when I learned that, I thought, oh my God. I mean, we're really worse off than you would think. There's still so much that's banking on technology, and it's nowhere near close to be doing what we wanted or what we needed to be.
And I think our, just to jump in for a second, one of the reasons why we have so much faith in technology is that we've had this couple hundred year run of ever rising incomes, especially in the West, and technological advancement. But there's a pretty reasonable perspective on that period of economic growth, which we're the beneficiaries of, that it is really just the story that we're extracting fossil fuels and burning them. And that the entire history of economic growth, which basically didn't exist before the 19th century, is the story of the added value of carbon. And that once we stop using carbon, we will be unable to produce meaningful, sustained economic growth going forward. Which is, you know, imperils our whole, all of our trajectories of growth and technological progress, which, as you say, we're counting on to save the planet.
I got to interview the retired CEO of Conoco, who I actually liked very much, and who doesn't believe in climate change. And he said, you know, Bill, there are all kinds of people in the third world who want to be able to take a hot shower and don't want to have to cook over cow dung anymore. And they're going to head in that direction, and we can't stop them. You know, our tragedy, really, is the tragedy of continually increasing demand. You can blame that, if you like, on the capitalist system, although the Soviets were all saying, you know, don't worry, the next five-year plan, we're going to give this much more to the people. So much of this increase in demand is tied up with the legitimate aspirations of very, very poor people who just want to have what we want. And I think that's what really surprised me when I started thinking about it. We can blame certain people, but you know, can I blame this old lady in Bangladesh I saw who was carrying shocks of corn by hand and sweating? And how nice if she could have gone home to a little air conditioner or had some filter for her water so she wouldn't get sick, or a little electrical help to carry this corn. You know, what can I say to that?
I think I have time for one more question before we turn it to the audience. And so after this enriching and at times dispiriting, but also fascinating conversation, I'm just really curious, and I ask you this as a panel moderator, but also as someone who is a fan of all of your work. So I care about you, and I want to know how you're doing. How do you feel about the future? Are you hopeful, or are you despairing? Gently?
I'm not despairing. In moments I am, but I don't think I could get up every day and I don't know. There's enough that's driving me. You know, there's enough that's scary that drives me to do what I do. But at the same thing, I think it would be hard to sustain if I didn't have some hope. But again, I don't know what that hope is exactly, other than I think like you, Bill, I hope I can make a difference in the world. Like, I hope I can do something. You know, if somebody was going to ask me on my deathbed, I think I would like to be able to say, I did my best, I tried, you know, and that's the best I can do.
I guess for me, it depends on what your, you know, what your definition of hopefulness is. You know, once you've wrapped your mind around the fact that, like, the planet could conceivably be made uninhabitable in the next century, then something that looks, from our vantage, like total environmental degradation and devastation is like a positive outcome and a reason for hope. And personally, I think that we're much likelier to end up somewhere at like 3 degrees of warming, which is going to be devastating in all of these ways, but which will still be able to support human civilization like the one that we have now, with many, you know, many people suffering a lot, but still sort of carrying on the torch, so to speak. And, you know, that, you know, depending on where you stand, that can be a hopeful perspective, as, like, horrifying as it is to say. And, you know, the other thing about that is just to connect something I was saying before. You know, we've engineered this devastation in the space of a lifetime or two lifetimes, and we now hold it in our power to forestall that, to slow it down. I think most indications are that we are not taking nearly as much action as we should, and things therefore are still, you know, just getting worse and worse, even as we get more scared about what's possible. But the ultimate lesson of climate change is that, you know, for me anyway, that it is also an invention of human hands. And as a result, you can imagine human action being up to the task. You know, there are a lot of reasons, again, to be not optimistic about doing that, but it is conceivably possible. It's been really interesting to me to see on the right, among deniers, there's this line that all of the temperature variations we're seeing are the result of natural variations, and that therefore we should be less worried about them. And it's like, well, you know, if it was out of our control, that's way scarier. And, you know, the fact that we've engineered it means that we are on some level in control of it. We don't have have an adequate politics to take control of it. We don't have an adequate, energy, new energy sources, etc., to take control of it in the way that we should. But on some theoretical level, it is within our control, and therefore, like, you know, there is, I think, reason for some moderate hope.
I've always loved apocalyptic science fiction, and so I couldn't help but just really enjoy David's article. And I thought, you know, now I'm going to be the hero, at least to myself, of one of these horrible stories. It's kind of an adventure in a way. I don't know how many of you read the book or saw the movie The Road, you know, but that had quite an effect on me. And at first I thought, you know, how grim, how terrible. And then I thought, you know, the father's love for his son and the desire to have his son live on after him, how wonderfully ordinary, you know, like, I hope that my daughter's going to be around after I'm gone. And I hope the human race is going to live on after I'm gone, you know, and I'll do what little I can, but I know that at some point I have to be gone, and it's not that bad.
Well, thank you guys very much. I think we now have time for questions from the audience. Does anyone want to ask? Mrs. Stillman, right here.
Hi, I have a question. Great panel, thank you very much. I'm curious, if all three of you were wildly successful, and you had just a huge readership, massive, let's say the billions of people, suddenly understood what you understand, on a very practical level, then what would they do?
I'm elect politicians who made climate a first order priority and not like a sixth or seventh order priority. I think that's the, for me, that's the main thing.
Switch to renewable energy. And I think the consumerism in the developed countries has to go down. Like there would be a huge, I think there would be a shift in values. Yeah, that would the values that would sustain a different world.
Reduce demand for almost everything. You could do that by reducing population, by reducing consumption, by making manufacturing and agriculture more efficient. None of it may be enough, but that's what I would have everybody do.
I recently went to hear Naomi Klein and Michelle Alexander. I don't know if maybe you were there. And what I liked about it was talking about the intersectionality between progressive movements and basically saving the environment. And that was really hopeful. Speak to that from your point of view, because what Naomi Klein is saying is that the solution to both things is one thing. It's people that are working in progressive movements also focusing on the degradation of the earth. And you touched on it a little bit when in your last statement when you talked about people in third world countries. And I thought it was sorely missing in some of the other comments that it's all just about manufacturing and technology, when the fact is this has been going on for basically the rise of Europe in the world. You know, it didn't just start, you know, in your dad's generation. That's just when it picked up, but it started with, you know, the land coming from the Native Americans and the forcing of people from one continent to the other as labor. So when Michelle and Naomi talked about bringing these two things together to find a common solution, to me it was hopeful. Talk about how you see climate change interacting with other progressive movements, and if you think there's any hope there for the two to marry and find solutions.
I think that oftentimes environmental disasters affect disadvantaged people. In West Virginia, there was a horrible chemical spill in 2014 of a coal cleaning chemical that affected the drinking water of about 300,000 people. And, you know, they're only rednecks from Appalachia, so who cares, you know? But as more and more of this stuff happens, I think people who are from these communities think, you know what, this is really, really important for me. When I was in college, I was in the anti-nuclear movement, and we went to an occupation blockade at Seabrook, New Hampshire. This was in 1980. And, you know, some of the townspeople told me, look, you know, you're just a bunch of privileged white kids. You know, the people of color don't have time for your, you know, aesthetic skullduggery. You know, do something useful. And now I think it's really nice to see more and more people of all races and creeds seeing, yeah, this is important, and the more we can all work together and say, it's not just about protecting, you know, some mountain where some rich person lives. It's about protecting the air and the climate, you know, for all of us, you know, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, as Bill was just saying, I mean, the impacts of climate change are going to be felt overwhelmingly by the world's poor, and that's, you know, tragic on many different levels. Bangladesh is like really like the kind of ground zero. I mean, the whole country could well be underwater by the end of the century, and that's completely horrifying. Those are hundreds of millions of people. And considering that the Syrian refugee crisis, which was just several million, like completely scrambled European geopolitics, you can just imagine what a refugee crisis that's 100 times or more will do to our global politics. And I think it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, that it's as I said, like, these are the people who are suffering the most. But I think it's also important to remember that the main drivers of our fate are, as Bill was saying a minute ago, is the growth and modernization of, in particular, India and China. And China in particular has been, taken huge steps over the last year or two, which is very, very helpful. But they're not taking those steps for progressive reasons. They're taking those steps because they want to save their population from the public health disasters that they've seen industrialization inflict on the country. And as weird as it is to say, like, we turn towards Xi Jinping to, like, save us. It's not, you know, the domestic politics in America are so limited in how they can affect the fate of the world. And really, like, the dictatorship of this one country, China, is going to be much, much, much more important to the lives of our children and grandchildren. And that's, as activists, pseudo-activists, halftime activists, like, that's a little bit hard to wrap our heads around. But truthfully, like, the behavior of the United States, even the behavior of all of the West, is marginal compared to the impact that India and China will have on the next century or two of climate. And I applaud activism here for sure, and I'm a man of the left personally, and but I'm mostly, I'm just crossing my fingers and hoping that the leaders in India and China do what is necessary and important. And in a kind of perverse way, I actually see the actions that China has taken as being inspired by the evacuation of American moral leadership on climate. That if Hillary Clinton was president and we were still a party to the Paris Accords and still trying to, like, rally the world, I'm not sure that Xi Jinping would have been as aggressive in taking action as he has. And I think there's a way in which we look back 30 years from now and say, weirdly, the election of Donald Trump was, like, the best thing that would happen to the planet, because it really spurred action among the nations in the world that we needed to take action. Not that we don't need to take action, but we're, you know, we have less of an impact.
Just a comment over here.
Yeah, it's amazing you brought up China, because I was in Hong Kong 2 weeks ago. You never see a blue sky. My children live there. And my son wanted to go to Beijing. Now there's the number 300. Is that the carbon that's safe?
The air quality index, I think.
Okay. Parts per million, probably.
Okay, it was 1,200 the week he was there. This is 2 weeks ago. 1,200 and 300 is supposed to be the limit. And everyone, every single person, this is Beijing, everyone had a mask. They stayed in the reserve of banking, and the expat worked in there. So I wanted to ask you, so I'm a little worried, and I was in Hungary in the 90s when they had those gold cars, and you couldn't even breathe, and your whole body fell apart in the 90s. Remember, and I think we came in and cleaned up a lot of the air. And I want to ask you, where could we have been, do you think, if Gore had won? I hate to do all this. I mean, what do you think he could have gotten done, you know, if he had a Congress? I'd like you to answer that, if you don't mind.
Well, on some level, the answer is about the limits of the kinds of national government and international cooperation that we have. I mean, no nation that signed the Paris Accord is on track to meet its obligations. Not a single one. So the leadership of a single individual who was committed to this issue could have made some difference, for sure, and probably also would have done less destruction to the sort of US-led post-Cold War global order that could have been a much more efficient way of handling this issue than the place we find ourselves in now. But it's really hard to keep these commitments. We're addicted to economic growth, and in many parts of the world that means burning more fossil fuels rather than less. And for many reasons, I wish that Al Gore had been elected president. It's amazing that that election, which seemed at the time to be, like, the least consequential election in American history, may have been, like, the most consequential in American history. I think that a lot of these forces are much bigger than a single individual. And yeah, that's how I answer that. I don't know if you guys have different perspectives.
I guess the other thing I would say is that where we really started going it alone was after September 11th. And so if Gore had been president when September 11th happened, and he had actually worked more with the international community, then maybe we all could have gotten more done. It's hard to say.
I just, one other thing about the air quality that you mentioned. There was a study a few weeks ago that just looking at the air quality difference between what we would have if we were a 1.5 degree warmer world and a world that was 2 degrees warmer. So 2 degrees is like the Paris goal. It's almost certainly we're not going to hit it, but it's like the optimistic goal. 1.5 is like the you're crazy optimistic that things will get there. But in the gap between 1.5 and 2 degrees, the statistician said would cost 150 million lives just from the carbon, not the non-carbon pollution in the air that would be produced by the difference in those two warming thresholds. So that is, you know, 25 holocausts that we will be inevitably inflicting on the world just by, if we meet the optimistic goal of the Paris Accords, we will be inflicting 25 holocausts of death just from the non-carbon pollution that it will be in the atmosphere on top of all the suffering that would have happened at 1.5 degrees, and we're almost certain to blow past 2 degrees to get to, I would say, 3 or 3.5 degrees by the end of the century. And, you know, it's just amazing how little moral opprobrium is attached to that indifference.
On the bright side, think how all those deaths will reduce demand.
That's a good point.
I think I saw a hand over here in blue.
I come from Europe, from Italy, where climate change is talked about in a completely different way. And so I'm very sensitive and interested in how climate change is discussed and what you call the storytelling, so the narratives around it. And so I wonder whether perhaps one of the reasons why climate change hasn't really been talked about as a sexy, what to say, topic. Wrong words to refer to it. So I wonder whether perhaps you should think about new ways of phrasing the very topic, climate change. It sounds to me as a very neutral kind of phrasing that perhaps doesn't alert people as it should be.
Do you have some suggestions?
Well, I think that in Italy we perceive, we have a different sense of how global history has been affected by our colonialist past. And so we tackle with the issue of guilt in a different way. And so the actual phrasing is the same, but it resonates with us in a different way. And so the question of whether climate change is happening or not is not a question. It's actually we are sure that this is happening, just a matter of how to deal with it. Whereas here in the US, there is still a conversation about whether or not we are going towards this direction. So I don't have an alternative, but I would want.
I know that sometimes people are successful talking about it, depending on who the audience is, in terms that matters to them. Like, they will talk to farmers about things that affect, you know, their farming without having to say the words climate change. And then at least we leave that out of the equation, the whole political weight of climate change out of the equation, and they're able to come to some, I've met somebody who tries to help farmers be more effective and be more sustainable. And it is something that has to do with climate change, but she doesn't use those words at all. And she just uses the terminology that they use, and she is trying to help them be better. So, you know, if we can engage people in that way, sometimes we can bypass the political charge of climate change.
And I think extreme weather is really useful in this respect too. I mean, it used to be that if you were trying to get people scared about climate change, you'd have to be projecting deeply into the future. And now there's enough really horrifying climate disaster that you can just point to the news, you can point to, you know, that year's meteorological data. And most people understand what an unprecedented time we're living in. I think that's very helpful, even if it's also terrifying.
We have time for one more question. let's see, Ali, you saw the hand in the back.
I guess I'll stand up because I'm pumped. What do you guys think? I know we always talk about like our children, our children's children, like future generations, that will really put the effect. What do you think about like space as kind of a way to, you know, like I know Elon Musk is going, you know, trying to go to Mars and find a way to, you know, plant, you know, seeds so that future generations can kind of mitigate the stuff that's around it. I just wanted to like, see you guys, your opinion on that sort of kind of option instead of staying grounded and trying to mitigate stuff.
If we don't learn from what we've done here, I doubt we can do better on another planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the absolute worst case climate scenario for Earth is going to be way, 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 way more habitable than any of the other planets that we're talking about visiting. So there is scientific value in visiting them and maybe even in colonizing them, but it's going to be a lot harder to set up like a large-scale colony on Mars than it would be to save a totally degraded Earth for human. I mean, you know, if you need to build like a greenhouse, you could just build a greenhouse here. So, I mean, I think it's basically a little bit crazy.
Yeah, it seems as if there would be a very small number of people, and in the future they might become genetically inbred. There'd be a lot of radiation damage on the way, and in a way, it might not be much different from a very few people surviving on Earth somewhere.
Phil, David, Chantel, thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for also being here this evening. There